In the spring of 1944, outside the farming hamlet of Sussac in south-central France, an old water mill, long disused, rumbled back to life. The mill was housed in a rock hut built right over a gentle stream feeding the Combad River. Screened by brush and trees, the hut looked abandoned from the dirt road outside, its windows frameless. In addition to its wooden water wheel, though, the hut contained minimal furnishings: a chair, a table, two bedsteads with dubious mattresses, a stone sink that drained outside into a hedge. This was now the temporary home of a man identified in his official papers and ration books as Claude-Jean Guillot. Guillot's documents showed him to be a 27-year-old French office boy employed by an agronomist in Toulouse. He was of medium height and build, though unusually fit. As if to dial back the striking effect of his looks, fine nose, strong chin, brown eyes set wide apart, the photograph on his identity card showed him with his necktie and collar awkwardly askew. His clothing was tailored in the contemporary French manner, down to the buttons and stitching. His spoken French was accentless. But he was, in fact, an American agent, the wireless operator for an elite team running a covert campaign of sabotage, subversion, and ambush against the German occupiers. His real name was Jean-Claude Guillet. His real age was 20. The slow turning of the old water wheel was vastly improving his life expectancy, measurable, as he well knew, not in years or even months, but weeks. The Germans, by that late stage of World War II, had become very good at radio direction finding. The Nazi Funkhochdienst, or listening service, monitored the entire radio spectrum between 10 kilocycles and 30 megacycles from a facility near Paris. Any frequency in use anywhere in France showed up as a spot on one of 300 softly humming cathode ray displays there. If a new unfamiliar spot appeared, its frequency would be called in to three direction-finding DF stations on the country's periphery, which would fix on the signal instantly and pinpoint it within a triangular area about 10 miles per side. Then the hunt would begin. The first step was to momentarily shut down the electrical power grid, one substation at a time, in the zone identified. If the spot blipped off and on, it meant that the radio drew power from that substation. Then technical teams operating mobile DF stations, often carried in disguised laundry trucks, but also sometimes in cars or small planes, would take over and narrow the field to within 200 yards of the transmitter. Finally, if necessary, Gestapo men on foot, using sensors hidden under coats, antennae looped around their necks, eyes on meters disguised as wristwatches, would close in. In 1944, the procedure, from the detection of a signal to the dispatching of DF vehicles, took as little as 14 minutes. Wireless operators were special prizes for the German military, as they were the vital link between resistance fighters and the London spy masters who supplied arms, ammunition, and money by moonlight parachute drops. Captured agents were supposed to either swallow their L pill, potassium cyanide, the L standing for lethal, or if they could not, to remain silent for the first 48 hours of interrogation, giving their fellows time to get clear. The risk was never far from Jean-Claude's mind. His reason for being there was that the team's previous radio operator had been captured months earlier near Rouen. Jean-Claude's borrowed watermill was a superb spot for operating his wireless set, a medium-power suitcase transceiver, as it offered both concealment and an off-the-grid power supply. Helped by an electrician friendly to the resistance, Jean-Claude had disconnected the heavy millstone from the water wheel's shaft and propped it against the hut's wall. Then the two men had rigged belts and wooden gears to the shaft, the last belt stretched tightly over a pulley driving a small generator. The system amplified the slow turning of the water wheel to a rate sufficient to charge a pair of scrounged 12-volt car batteries, which powered the radio. A long copper wire, threaded through a cracked roof tile and strung up into the branches of a tree, served as an antenna. Even so, Jean-Claude knew he was in peril every time he switched on his set. DF trucks occasionally roamed the countryside. A small plane flew overhead with unsettling regularity, most likely a German courier, Jean-Claude thought, but possibly not. Worse, one member of Jean-Claude's four-person team, Violette Sabo, had been captured and handed over to the Gestapo in Limoges. Who knew what information they might have extracted from her?